It's Monday, March 18th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And this is a special week, perhaps a scary week. Perhaps it will be enlightening, eye-opening, and will take some of your fear away, for it is Crime Week. As you know, I talk a lot about crime, and I was one of those people a couple of years ago who were saying the Democrats are vulnerable about crime because crime is going up. Don't pay attention, or pay a little bit of attention, but don't take on faith the fact that there was a 1 year or a 1 or 2 year slight drop in crime in the years 2022 or 2021. Crime had spiked so much, especially murder in big cities and in small cities, had spiked so much that people were correct and right to be more afraid than they had been. There is an industry, a cottage industry, and I grew up in this industry of media saying, oh, all these fears about crime are unwarranted, because it was largely true as we, people of my generation, I'm 52, as we came up in the industry, and this was a time when crime was not out of control, crime was getting under control, and then during the Obama years, crime was at its lowest ebb or lowest ebb in many, many decades, and still, if it bled, it led, and stories of crime were used to scare people, and the perennial survey that said that people were scared of crime in their neighborhood and think the crime was going up, that was just that, a perennial. But now, in 2024, I am here to tell you, and I'd like to retain some believability and credibility on the issue, that crime really has come down, not just single-digit percent from last year, but significantly. And when you compare the crime figures from what we're experiencing right now to even before the pandemic, things not in every city and not in every place and not in every way have corrected, but there has been a lot of correction. And so on this, the first episode of Crime Week, we are joined for the whole show by Jeff Asher. He is one of the best data purveyors of crimes out there. He's the co-founder of AH Datalytics. He is the author of the Jeffalytics Substack. He is one of my go-tos where we talk about what is really happening with crime. And also, we're going to talk about a bit of a meta conversation of how do we even know what's happening and how are these crime statistics actually conceived of and called. So for the whole show, there'll be a bit of a break in between. But for the whole show, we bring you a conversation with Jeff Asher on crime. A lot of times when you hear about VPNs, I find that they just assume you know what they are, or even if you have an understanding, oh, they're a virtual private network, you might not know the acronym, but in general, don't they mask what you do online? Why do I need that? People don't explain it correctly, and it was explained to me when I got into the beneficial aspects of Surfshark. So a VPN does mask what you do online, and that's really important for some people who, might be trying to be a dissident in an oppressive regime. It's also just important in terms of general hygiene for why do you have to let every advertiser and everyone else know where you were and, you know, follow your tracks. But I find it's also very practical. Like I said, it's a mask. And so a mask does hide identity, but a mask, a well-fitted N95 mask, also might protect you, which is what a VPN does too. Practically, however, in my life, there are many websites that when I'm traveling, I can't access. I have and pay for access to them. Then I find myself in as far-flung a place as Canada. Sometimes, as an American, a foreign version of, say, Netflix would come in handy. I'd like to watch some of those shows, and I'm not just talking about Czechoslovak soap operas. I'm talking about how the excellent movies move in and out of the different Netflix in different localities. With a really good VPN like Surfshark, you could access all of them. And another big one for me is there is a major broadcaster in Britain. It is a broadcasting company there, but they don't let me hear all the stuff that someone there can hear. With a VPN, I could listen to that as if I were there. There are so many practical uses, plus the traditional use of why let them know exactly what you're doing. Your surfing is for you. A VPN allows you to surf what you want to surf, where you want to surf, without interference from, let's say, repressive governments or the Czech Netflix regime. Get Surfshark VPN at surfshark.deals/gist. What are those deals? Well, Enter promo code GIST for 3 extra months for free. You heard me right. 3 extra months for free. That's surfshark.deals/GIST. The Defender is a beautiful car, but beauty is, of course, sometimes only skin deep. Not with the Defender. Let's talk about the interior. It's robust, built with integrity. Yes, it's designed iconically, the exterior. That's what compelled me. My neighbor Jay says, Mike, you see what's on the block? It's a Defender. And I look down the block, and indeed there is. And me and Jay, the neighbor, and Michelle, we gather around the Defender. We peer in the window. I have to say, I don't want to make this a little too tawdry, but we lust, or perhaps we cavil. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. We looked at the cargo capacity, more room for the gear. There's really a wide range of adventures. The Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender. If you listen to the show, you know one of my main interests is crime stats, really, because they tell us about crime, which I am opposed to. One of the best analysts of the data, which is not always easy to get and understand and sift through, is Jeff Asher. He's a data analyst, a consultant, a co-founder of AH Datalytics, and he substacks at Jeffalytics. That would be, well, jasher.substack.com is the way to find his Substack, and the way to find his insights is to listen to this interview we're about to embark upon right now. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. Tell me about the crime trends in major cities that you have been paying attention to and where that tells us where we may be going nationally in terms of homicide rates.
So first, starting way at the 30,000 foot view, crime data is really slow. And so the FBI won't release its crime data for 2023 until probably October 2024, which will be great fun, you know, 3 weeks before a major election and with, you know, huge implications for seeing, as we'll talk about, some of the major changes in crime. So the workaround is typically if you get a large enough sample of cities, you can be predictive of the national trend. So if you have 30 cities of data, you might be within 3-4% of the national trend. If you have 100, 150, 200 cities of data, you're going to get somewhere in the 2-3% of within the national trend. So by collecting city data, we're able to figure out what the trend might look like, especially for homicide, just because it's the crime that most cities publish most frequently. And so we have, I believe, 210 cities of data for 2023 compared to 2022. The vast majority of those cities are through kind of at least the end of November. Yes. A majority, we have a full year of data. So we're not talking about mid-year to mid-year. We're for the most part talking about year on year. And it shows murder down around 12% in those cities.
From year to year, yes.
Year on year. So compared to 2022, and in 2022, the FBI reported about a 6% decline from 2021. And obviously we had 30% increase in 2020, a 4% increase in 2021. And so we're going to see what will be most likely either the largest or one of the largest one-year declines in 2023.
Right, but the largest, we'll get into many of the implications of what you said, but just because you ended there. But the largest decline, true, absolute fact, is but a portion of the largest, a much larger increase that happened a couple years ago. So take us back to pre-pandemic, where are we?
So 2014, the U.S. hits the lowest murder rate either ever recorded or since the like early 1960s. It was the pinnacle, the year that people that sort of study this point to as the low point in murder. 2015 and 2016, there were reasonably large increases. And then 2017 to 2019, but you're talking about 10 to 12% increases both years. So nowhere near what we saw in 2020, but after the lowest year ever recorded, we had things sort of tick up. 2017 to 2019, things sort of stayed about the same. And then summer of 2020 hits and murder surges and it goes up 30%. The previous largest 1 year increase was about 12.5% or 12.8%. Mm-hmm. So 30% increase was by and away the largest 1 year increase. And it wasn't just because we were at a low number of murders. There were almost 5,000 more murders in 2020 than 2019,
right?
Which is both the largest percent increase and the largest number of just raw total of murders increase ever recorded. Like I said, 2021, we kind of hung out at the same level before starting to see a decline in 2022 and seeing that decline accelerate through 2023 to where we're still above where we were in 2019. You're right about that. But we're below where we were in 2020 and significantly closer to 2019's level than 2020 right now.
Right. What has been the increase since 2019?
The increase is since 2019, if you give me a second, I can find...
And people should know, don't you just have to add the numbers and subtract? No, because when murder goes up or when any statistic goes up 30% and then goes down 12%, you have to take 12% off the 130, not 12% off 100. So here goes Jeff. He's calculating as we speak. We could play some background music.
It's all a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
The murder rate in 2019 was around 5 murders per 100,000. Mm-hmm. In 2014, it was 4.4 per 100,000 mm-hmm. by comparison. In 2020, it hit almost 7 per 100,000. So 6.8 per 100,000. That's 5,000 more murders than in 2019.
Yeah.
Our best estimate for 2023, if murder fell 12%, like the big city data suggests it did, and you got to put a margin of error in there, it would be around 5.5 per 100,000.
Right.
So still, you're talking about what, the 10% above where it was in 2019, mm-hmm. but significantly lower than where it was in 2020 and 2021 when it was, it wasn't quite as bad as the 90s in those years, but it was about as close as we've been since the end of the 90s.
Right. In terms of bodies, though, I'm doing the quick math. If we're a country of 330 million and that's per 100,000, that means we have 3,300 hundred thousands. And if it goes up half a point, seems like about 1,600 more bodies than in 2019.
Let's see. Around there, yeah, it's closer to about 2,000. But that's back of the napkin math, that's pretty good. Down around about 4,000-ish. From 2021 peak.
Right.
Still lower in 2021 than 91 when we had almost 25,000 murder victims. But the makeup of murder victims in 2021 was different from when it was in 1991 in terms of the number of firearm victims. So probably had the most fatally shot murder victims in 2021 ever recorded in the United States.
Yeah. And that's a little crazy it's a little crazy for all the humanitarian reasons, but here I am telling you this. But people should know our medical technology is getting better and, you know, faster and able to treat wounds and get people to hospitals. And I've read some pretty credible reports that so much of the decline in murder is just based on our ability to treat people who've been shot. So since that peak, if we've had more of the crime victims, more of the murder victims being gunshot victims, it tells us that the problem of people being shot is getting even worse than that.
Yeah, probably. And I think you could make the argument, and I believe the argument, that recent years, medical technology has advanced to the point where the murder rate would be much, much worse if we had to do 1990 or 1970 technology on our shooting victims. I think when people apply it to, you know, why did murder go up
like a
2020?
Right, a 3-year trend.
Yeah, that
the technology hasn't plateaued so much.
Right? You can point to places. I'm in New Orleans. New Orleans in 2015 opened up the only tier one medical facility that could handle, you know, the worst of the worst trauma one facility, I think they call it, or level one trauma facility. So I think you could build a case that, hey, New Orleans has probably in the last decade gotten better. But murder doesn't go up or down from year to year because of medical technology changing.
Right. Who's being murdered?
So Americans.
Yeah.
In most cities, the vast majority of victims are African American. Oftentimes, kind of the people at highest risk and the highest rate of violence is young African American men. Typically, those that are, there's all this work from this guy Andy Papakristos at Northwestern has done that has looked at the networks of people that are involved in homicides. And especially in places like Chicago, there is a disproportionate share of your victims who are either the associates of previous shooting victims. So basically, gun violence spreads like a disease. So right. You and I are friends, Mike. You get shot to death. My risk of, because we're running the same circles, we know the same people, we're engaged oftentimes in the same risky behaviors that lead to someone like yourself getting involved in gun violence, then my risk suddenly skyrockets. And
right. Now, I got to say, Jeff, we are friends. We just met 15 minutes ago, but I'm not going to avenge you if you get shot.
Well, but in this hypothetical, you're the one that got shot. Yes. So it's up to me.
Oh, damn. Turning it around. That's true. And we should also note you look at all the data, but the city data will skew more African-American than the national data. But tell me if I'm wrong. It's often reported that the victims of that murder victims are disproportionately African American. From what I see, the FBI national statistics, we could take out the disproportionately. Most murdered people, tell me if I'm wrong, most murdered people in America last year were Black.
I don't believe that's correct.
No. Okay.
I believe that the rate is probably highest, but
well, yeah,
that the majority of victims, based on just demographic information, the majority of victims are white. But
okay, I'd like to look at that because I have seen, and these are the FBI statistics.
Oh, you know what? You're maybe, right. You're absolutely right. I'm rejecting my previous statement that. So I pulled up the 2019 numbers really quickly. 7,500 Black victims. Of those that are known, I should caveat that. The FBI doesn't get full reporting on every murder victim. So it's not something that you necessarily have data on every victim, though I don't know that if you had data, if you have 2/3 of the victims, I don't know that the other third would necessarily skew those totals.
And in the rise, in the 30-ish percent rise in murder that coincided with the pandemic, Black people were being murdered, not just as we've established, mostly because that's been the case. They were even compared to the baseline being murdered disproportionately. Isn't that right?
I don't have those exact figures, so I don't want to go out on a limb and answer that specifically. But what we found is that it wasn't just a big city thing. And murder was up in cities of a million or more, the exact same percentage as those that cities that were 10,000 or less. Murder went up in the suburbs. It went up in rural counties. And we're seeing a very similar trend in 2023 as far as murder going down everywhere. It's going down in big cities. It's going down in small cities. It's going down in rural counties and suburban counties. So what we're seeing is, I think because we have city data, we tend to think about these trends in light of cities.
Yeah.
But what we're seeing from the data that we do have is that it's not just a big city thing. It's really, it's an everywhere thing.
But it's also more of a gun thing. A higher percentage of murders are firearm murders than were 10 or 20 years ago. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In 2022, I think it was about 77%, which has been where it's kind of been hovering the last few years. It was in the 60% 10, 15 years ago. It was even lower than that in the 90s. And so that has huge implications for things like solvability of crimes, you know, interrupting retribution killings with police action. And obviously, stabbings are probably more survivable than shootings with certain firearms. So it has huge implications for everything that we look at when we look at these crimes.
So there are a couple of big exceptions to the decline in city murder rates. And this is going to happen with statistics. If home runs are up in baseball, it doesn't mean the third baseman on your particular team will have more home runs than last year. It doesn't mean that whole teams will exceed their pace. So there's variation in statistics. However, when you look at the murder rate in Washington, D.C., or the murder rate in Memphis, Tennessee, it's gone up a lot. It's resisting these national trends. So is there any reason for that that you would think other than, you know, just because something's a trend, it doesn't mean that it's uniform?
So I think there's a couple of explanations. One, you look at a place like Greensboro, North Carolina, which had like 72 murders up from 40 something in 2022, yes. A huge increase. But then you look at their number of aggravated assaults by firearm and you see it was down like 10%. And so, you know, the bullet leaves the gun. There's a lot of luck or randomness that happens. And so you can look at certain places that are seen, or Seattle, which saw the most murders it had ever reported, but had fewer shooting victims. When you're talking about a low base rate probability of something happening, sometimes you just see huge variations and it's just luck or randomness and you would expect it to go back the other way. I'm not saying that's everywhere. I'm saying there are places where that is a more plausible explanation.
Yeah, then but not in D.C.
Not in D.C., but when I looked at this in D.C., and I did a post on this, I think in November or December, I looked at all the places where it's going down, and then I looked at here are the outliers. And D.C. and Memphis, I think, are the two that stand out. Memphis is a little easier to explain because you've seen all of these responses after Tyre Nichols' death. You have these huge police community trust, police legitimacy issues. All of the things that maybe contributed to murder going up in 2020 nationally are occurring again in Memphis. And I think that you can point to that. And it's like, it's really bad there. DC, I don't think you have necessarily those issues. And what I thought about DC, and I think about DC in light of New Orleans, is that sometimes there's just outliers. And because these things are so complex and these trends have so many variables that we can't really know them. We can't really explain why a place is an outlier that's not following the national trend. I think about New Orleans. Murder peaked nationally in 91. It started to come down. Murder in 94 in New Orleans had the worst murder rate that any American city had ever recorded up to that point.
Yeah, I believe, tell me if I'm right, there was a point where it stopped being mentioned as the most murderous city because its population dipped below 500,000, the most murderous large city. But had you just filled in the extra number of people, it would by far be the most murderous large city.
Yeah, well, in 2007, after Katrina, New Orleans dipped below 250. And,
wow.
And so... So then New Orleans had 207 murders with 220,000 people. So New Orleans had this horrific experience, and murder fell 5 years after it fell nationally. And when it fell seriously. But what are the factors that were specific to New Orleans that meant it didn't follow the national trend? I don't know what those are. I'd point to New Orleans also in 2022 when murder fell 6%. New Orleans had a 30% or 20% increase in murder to the highest murder rate since Katrina, or since before Katrina. And then in 2023, it was just as bad. And then in the summer, it just a switch flipped and murder started, it fell off a cliff. And so I think that sometimes there are just outlier cities.
Yes.
And we're kind of starting, and I'm very hopeful with DC that we're seeing it. Murder, the 9 murders so far this year in DC compared to 18 at this point in 2022. Or 2023, through January, they had the fewest murders in DC in any year since, I believe, 2018. You're kind of seeing with a lot of crimes in DC, the beginning of maybe the turnover. It could be other things. It could be just that January was colder or, you know, Congress wasn't in session. So people weren't driven to crime or something. Whatever random excuse there might be. But you might be also starting to see that DC was an outlier, but we would eventually expect it to follow the national trend. And maybe we're starting to see that.
So what causes a murder rate to go down? I see so many variables proposed. Poverty, bail reform, whether the local prosecutor identifies as progressive or not. The number of police, what shows to positively correlate?
So there's some research that the number of police loosely correlates with murder going up or down in a city, but it also leads to other things like, you know, more arrests for minor offenses that maybe you don't want. So it's not necessarily a go hire cops and your murder rate will suddenly fall X percent. I don't think that there's sort of that one-to-one correlation. And we're seeing in a lot of places that are still struggling with hiring officers, like New Orleans, that are now seeing big declines in the number of murders. I'm a huge believer that it's not related to prosecution. You look at a lot of places have 20, 30, 40% murder clearance rates, and the criminal justice system is so slow. So it may take years for these cases to reach the level of the prosecutor actually deciding whether or not they're going to try them. And all the progressive prosecutors in the country are still trying murder trials. There's not really a lot of appetite for, hey, you know, we're going to involve murderers in diversion programs, even amongst some of the most progressive of the prosecutors.
No, but the argument would go that bail or leniency is given to criminals, even violent criminals. And if those criminals go on to commit a murder, there could have been an interdiction before. That would be.
Yeah, I don't think that people respond to that as a deterrent factor. And we have all the criminological research that shows that the swiftness and certainty of getting caught is substantially more effective as a deterrent than the likelihood that you'll be punished. And so I'm not a huge believer that prosecutors are playing a big role in crime trends going up or down, especially with relates to murder. I think you could point to poverty. You could point to, you know, centuries of racial inequality. You could point to all of these big picture things, but I don't think that that's causing murder to suddenly go up or suddenly go down. I think that the things that caused it to go up in 2020 were, and you can kind of point to what sort of some of the ingredients might be. I can't print out the recipe and show you, here's how to bake the cake. But you can point to things like, you know, in the wake of George Floyd's murder that, you know, distrust in police expanded considerably. Police pulled back in a lot of cities, especially.
Yeah.
It wasn't necessarily a super long-term pullback, but it happened in a lot of places.
We'll be back in a moment with Jeff Asher talking more about crime statistics. We're back with Jeff Asher. He's the co-founder of AH Datalytics. Let's get at it once again. I do want to talk about the police pullback, because I have read, you probably read the same articles I have. Murder went down last year, Jeff Asher's stats show, and this coincided with a supposed, but not really documented, lowering of the number of police in America. It's true, slightly, ever so slightly lowered. And therefore, we can say that it's not true, less police equal more murder. But you just said the word pullback, and that's what I think is the much more compelling case, that it wasn't that there were fewer sworn officers, it's that what they did was to interact with the community less, for a lot of good reasons and bad reasons. So I'd like you to talk about that, the decline in police versus the decline in policing.
Well, I would take it a step further. It was really a pullback in government. It started during the pandemic. You know, city government did not reach out to the public. You didn't have, you know, philanthropic organizations, nonprofit organizations that really worked with people. They were not engaging with the people. And that also, you know, the earliest part of the pandemic, the police were part of that. And then you had George Floyd and a sort of second pullback where in a lot of places, but not everywhere. And so I think that if you see, we saw murder go up everywhere, but we didn't necessarily see police pull back everywhere. In a lot of places, we saw, you know, drops in arrests, drops in things like traffic stops that we use as sort of this metric for how frequently the police are engaging with the public. We saw that happen, and then we saw it kind of, some places it persisted and very slowly got back to more normal or reached a new normal. We have seen, and I think that this speaks to why we're seeing murder decline now, is that we've probably seen a new normal reached in terms of how police are interacting with people. But really starting in the summer of 2022, people, for the most part, the pandemic phase of COVID-19 ended. And so city government came back. People, either they got COVID or they sort of realized that, there's limited things you can do to prevent yourself from getting it or from being exposed to it. And so it stopped being this thing that was like the everyday driver of American life. And I think that that helped to reduce some of the stresses. You had city government start to engage. You had the nonprofit philanthropic world start to engage people again. And I think that these are the mechanisms that in a normal time would have been engaged in 2020 when murders started to rise and would have helped to interrupt this cycle of violence. But those didn't exist until really 2022, 2023. And I think that that helps to explain why we're now seeing it after 2 years starting to see this big decline.
So the one thing I would say about that is I do think we saw police pull back everywhere, or almost everywhere. And I know that there are statistics about police and public interactions, but I don't think that all of the pullback shows up in the statistics. And I'm not citing something, oh, it was a vibe. I think that there are many, many police interactions that don't show, aren't a stop, right? Aren't an arrest, are a casual contact, or a more than casual contact, but not something that you'd have to report on your forms. We're seeing a big debate about this in New York City. And it was quite clear that police knew that they were under the microscope. And so that's going to result in probably less police brutality, but also less interdiction in terms of things like crime and murder.
Well, and I definitely think that the data that we have, we saw that, but we have very incomplete data collection, and we certainly have no national data collection on things like that. We definitely saw what you're describing in a lot of cities. And there's great criminologist at Temple, Jerry Radcliffe, who I did a podcast with him, and he talked about and put the idea in my head, and it hasn't left, that the things that caused the increase, the summer of 2020, are not necessarily the things that sustained it in through the end of 2020, 2021. And then those are not necessarily the same things that are leading it down in 2022 and 2023.
Right. So what could cause the increase there, just simple human things. People are cooped up and angry, and we see driving get more aggressive. But also, because of the pandemic, who controls like the drug corners? Maybe it was a little more up for grabs. Then what could keep? And then there's the then there might be a spate of murders. There was a spate of murders. And then what's propelling it is what you were talking about before. Some criminologist, Patrick Shark, he's one of them, he's been on the show, talked about the retribution and the networks.
Yeah.
And now what's making it come down is a third thing, So yeah, that's probably all occurring at once, but I would just hate to think, and I've seen this framed so often, look, the pandemic was an exception, now it's all getting back to normal. That's not how it works. I mean, it is, if you follow the crests and the trends, it did go up during the pandemic. It did stay high the next year. It is going down now. But this is not just waves. This is not the tide. You can't just predict it like you can the tide coming in and out.
Well, and if the pandemic caused this, we would have seen the increase in March 2020 or February 2020. Mm-hmm. We see what the pandemic did to gun sales. Gun sales went through the roof in January, February 2020.
That's another correlation. Tell me if I'm wrong, but I see many good studies correlating more guns with more murders. It doesn't seem to blow one's mind, pardon the expression, but yeah, that's a fact.
Well, and I think that I think of it like as an accelerant on the fire that started in 2020, in summer of 2020, right? That you and I get into a fight in 2019, maybe we both have knives, or we just, duel it out with our fists and one of us goes to the hospital because you broke my jaw or something, but we're both alive. And now in summer of 2020, now we're both armed with guns that we wouldn't have had before. And, one of us shoots the other and it's now a homicide. And so it wasn't that we saw this increase in gun sales and then a sudden surge in shootings and killings. But I definitely think it didn't help matters in the summer of 2020. If it had been the pandemic, the timing does not match with everybody got cooped up and then they started shooting each other. the timing matches with everything that happened over the summer of 2020. And then once it started, we didn't have the strategies and the tactics that we would use to interrupt it. And so you create these cycles of violence, retribution killings. Jilliovian Ghettocide, which is probably the best book on gun violence out there, talks about the state monopoly on violence, that it's only the state that's going to make arrests and decide who is guilty of a murder, who's guilty, and go out and be the arbiter of justice. But in the absence of that state monopoly, which we definitely had in the summer of 2020, people take things into their own hands. You get retribution killings, you get cycles of violence, you get, and we didn't have any of the tools that we would have used to stop it.
So I want to ask a few more questions. These are mostly about our perceptions of crime, and there's a media component. So question one is, I've seen it stated frequently in recent months that while crime is going down, people feel that crime is going up. Gallup polls on this. However, I've seen all the polls, and I think this is a constant. People always tell Gallup that their perception is crime is going up, irrespective of actual crime trends. My question to you is there a correlation, however? They'll always say it's going up, but will they say it's going up less when it really is going down?
So I think the only time we've ever had a majority of people responding to Gallup that crime was not going up was in the early 2000s. So, and in the 90s, the late 90s, people recognized, and so a smaller share of people were saying that it's going up, even if a majority was saying that it's going up, when like we're having what's called the great crime decline, and you're still having 60% of Americans say that crime is going up. Even in 2014, when murder reached its low point, a majority of people said it had gone up from the previous year. But what we've seen is so detached from reality. I mean, it's the highest levels that we've seen since the 90s. And it's so politicized at this point that it doesn't, I mean, usually it like, yes, you're going to have a majority, but it's largely going to match the overall trend. You're going to have some people that recognize that it's not going up. And now it's less than a quarter of Americans think that the actual trend is the trend.
A frequent way to write about this is to note, to provide context. I'm all in favor of context, but context can say whatever you want it to say. So I think more often than not in the major daily newspapers, I see reporting on crime, especially when it was going up. And the context, it was de rigueur to say, of course, this isn't as close to where crime was in the 90s. And this is still going on, that crime is going up. Maybe there's an acknowledgement that crime is going up, or especially murder is growing up, but it's nowhere near the heights of murder in the late 80s, early 90s. In fact, depending on how you define close, I think it did get close. However, it bothers me that this has become de rigueur with this one statistic. When I see statistics about hunger, I almost never see, of course, the situation with how many people are food insecure in 2023 is nothing compared to, and then you could pick any time before the 1970s where it's much less. I don't see this with homelessness. I don't see this with other social issues where the assumption is, even if we've gotten better, there's still a lot of room to improve. How about you? Do you think it's necessary to say all the time that it's not as high as it was in the 90s? Or do you think that that's serving a public function? You're glad newspapers do that.
So as someone that writes about it, I'm always going to put the context in there, comparing it to the 90s and comparing it to the more recent history. Just like, I'm going to describe a graph. That's just like the way I write. But mm-hmm. I think that the 90s comparison doesn't hold much sway with me. And I think I agree with you. I'm a big Saints fan, big sports fan. So I think about it in terms of sports. The Saints in 1980, won one game. They went 1-15. They went won nine games last year, but nobody's saying, hey guys, we were 9-8. That's so much better than it was in 1981. Like, y'all should be happy with this. You compare yourself aspirationally. You don't compare yourself to the worst. And you compare it to where you've recently been. So if you go from, 3-14 to 7-10 to 10-7, you can say, oh, look, things are improving. We haven't won a Super Bowl yet, but things are improving. If you're only comparing to the worst it's ever been, then you're not really understanding your current trend, and you're not understanding how much progress you're making. And you're kind of doing yourself a disservice. What I want to know is, how does my team compare to the year they won the Super Bowl? Are we getting to what our aspirational goal is? Which is why I think it's okay to be encouraged by what we're seeing as a large decline, even if you can rightly point out that we're still above where we were pre-pandemic and we're way above where we were in 2014. But we're trending in the right direction and things look good. And so we should learn from that and try to understand, why are things getting better, in order to continue to continue that trend and expand on that trend. The comparison of the 90s, I think this, the context is important, but it's also meaningless to some degree.
Jeff Asher is a data analyst and a consultant. He's the co-founder of AH Datalytics. His Substack is Jeffalytics. Find it at jasher.substack.com. Jeff, great talking to you.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for today's show. The Gist is produced by Corey Wara. The senior producer is Joel Patterson. Michelle Pesca is CLO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Umpru, gpru, dupru, and thanks for listening.